Thank you, Brother James. Okay, tonight our exhortation is from Brother Jim Washick. His subject is Europe. And with that, I'll hand it over to Jim.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
The subject this evening, as you can see, is Europe, aka the European Union, historically styled as the cradle of Christianity, although Antioch much earlier had claimed to that title, and that the name Christian was first used there, as we find in Acts 11:26. And the disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. Now, this talk on Europe, I delivered a variation of this talk on Europe some 20 plus years ago, which I have since gone through and updated while keeping some of the original PowerPoints. In that, they tell the story of the development of Europe prior to its various states getting together in the mid-1950s and beyond, leading up to the creation of the European Union in 1992. Thus, you will see some dated PowerPoints, which I trust you'll find helpful in addressing the EU's history as well as its nature. Again, as well as its prophesied role in Revelation 17, where we will end with the 10 horned kings that make war with the Lamb. You know, Europe is an ancient history-filled continent of vast significance to Western civilization and indeed scriptural prophecy. So I'm kind of thumbs today. Europe is a continent of secular appeal. Ancient buildings, cathedrals, long history. Europe is a center of secular and liberal humanism, multiculturalism, and relativism. Now, from a spiritual perspective, Europe is the cradle of apostate Christianity. Yet, we recognize Europe through its scriptural description as the great whore, a woman sitting upon a scarlet-covered beast full of names of blasphemy. Upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, Revelation 17. Well, Christadelphians have long looked to Europe as the manifestation of the ten-toed nations of Daniel 2:41-43. In other words, the feet and toes, part of iron and part of potter's clay, as we see in Nebuchadnezzar's image. Likewise, we recognize Europe to encompass much of the territory of the Roman Empire, while Europe developed as part of Nebuchadnezzar's image, i.e. the western leg of the image of the kingdoms of men. Now, with that short introduction, let's look at Europe as it's known today, the European Union, the EU. Well, first, a little background. European history is riddled with wars and conflicts. In the 14th and 15th centuries, there was a 100 years war. The Napoleonic War occurred in the early 19th century. World War I and World War II involved European nations against one another. Now, after World War II, the Europeans decided that they needed a break from that past and maybe try to learn to cooperate with one another. In 1957, six European nations got together and founded the European Economic Community, the ECC, when they signed with what was called the Treaty of Rome. They established a common market, which they believed would bring stability and prosperity. As time went on, the European countries joined, or other European countries joined, and when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the door was open for expansion to the east within, as you can see, the European continent. So the European Union was formed in 1992 through the Treaty on European Union. Well, the EU has had and still has 27 member countries, resulting in the longest and the largest expanse of peace and widely shared prosperity on the planet. In today's world, it seems natural that the political union would follow economic union, and that is what we have been observing during the past 60 plus years over in Europe. The EU's goal was to unite and become one people with shared values and shared laws. Looking back on their past history of warfare, that word nationalism is a bad word, as is patriotism or devotion to one's nation, guarding the nation's interests and security. It's a bad word in Europe, while elsewhere in the world, it's a source of pride within individual nations. Keep in mind that Great Britain withdrew from the EU on January 31st, 2020. In other words, Brexit, as they no longer tolerated the EU telling them what they could and couldn't do. That's a simplification. But the EU's goal was to unite and become one people with shared values and shared laws. Looking back on their past history of warfare, the European Union Constitution. It's an interesting story, and it really tells us a lot about the nature of the EU and their tactics. On October 29, 2004, all the EU member states signed a treaty to establish what they called the EU Constitution. The Constitution was to replace existing overlapping treaties while codifying uniform rights and regulations, intended to streamline decision-making in this very large 27-country entity. It still had to be ratified, but in 2005, the French and Dutch voters rejected it, causing other EU countries to postpone or halt their ratification process. Now, at that juncture, only 18 of the 27 countries had ratified the Constitution. Well, enter on the scene German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel was the Chancellor of the EU from 2005 to 2021. That's the time most of this history is taking place. She was the primary driver of much of the period we will be addressing here. She declared it her goal to set the roadmap for adoption of a constitution, using high-pressure tactics with those countries that had not yet ratified. The pressure was on. She believed she was close to achieving her goal of an EU constitution. Yet, the EU already had a common trade policy, a common agricultural and fisheries policy, a single currency, the euro, a limited foreign security policy, a limited police and judicial cooperation, a European bank, a European court of justice, and a European parliament. However, in that these policies and institutions overlap policies and institutions of member countries, they frequently bumped up against and conflicted with those individual countries' laws and policies. Nevertheless, Merkel's United Europe dream awaited final consummation through ratification of the Constitution, which was to result in, as she said, one government and one voice representing all of the European Union. Over the objections of some of the EU countries, Chancellor Merkel moved ahead at a pace she thought to be unstoppable, but there was resistance, such as, this is from the Daily Telegraph, there is never a plan B in Brussels. Plan A is simply resubmitted over and over again until it's accepted. Indeed, with or without formal ratification, most of the policies and institutions proposed by the Constitution have been or are being enacted anyway. The European Defense Ministry and Diplomatic Corps, the European Public Prosecutor, the Charter of Fundamental Rights, the European Space Program. The EU, in other words, is behaving as if the French and Dutch electorates had voted yes and the Constitution was already in force. Still, the EU forged ahead with renewed determination to weaken public resistance and create an in-house news agency in which all EU news would emanate from the EU Commission, quote, giving them supremacy of interpretation in reporting its activities. In January 2007, the 18 member countries that had ratified the Constitution met to consider how they might convince the 9 holdout countries to ratify. Merkel and the 18 ratifying believed they could not succeed with individual and nationalistic state priorities continually challenge the EU's one government and one voice plan. Excuse me, this thing feels like it's all stepping down. Well, but from the holdouts' perspective, you know, I mean, they like the idea of a united and cooperative European Union, but they feared being governed by those outside their communities and their countries. Former German president had also something to say. Former German president says EU threatens democracy. Former German President Roman Herzog says parliamentary democracy in Germany is under serious threat as a result of significant errors in the development of the European Union. He writes, the EU has a worrying democratic deficit, and the separation of powers has de facto been abolished. Herzog and his allies believe the European Constitution does not improve matters, but rather demonstrates the EU's lack of transparency and its tendency to grab too much power for itself. In an article for the newspaper De Welt, he observed, the EU now generates 84% of its German law. The judicial activism of the European Court of Justice has a systematic tendency to favor the EU. There are no safeguards in the Constitution against infringement by the EU on matters that are the preserve of member states and the Constitution is not flexible enough to allow member states to work together in foreign policy on an ad hoc basis. This, it says, damages the EU's global interests. Well, long story short, the Constitution for Europe was never ratified, having been endorsed by only those original 18 member countries. The rejection of the document by French and Dutch voters in May and June of 2005 brought the ratification process to an end. Following a period of reflection, the Treaty of Lisbon, created to replace the Constitution, formed the constitutional basis of the European Union, approved in December 2009. Now, it's clear that there's still a lot of resistance. just within the last two weeks, I copied some information out of a news item. And this is how it reads. It's clear that the demand for nation rights within the EU continues. In a June 29, 2023 article, Germany and France indicated they are determined to reform European Union nation rights, including the right to veto EU laws and policies coming out of Brussels. Now, if you're not familiar with Brussels, Brussels is not only the capital of Belgium, but in style, the capital of the EU, in that they host the majority of the EU committees. Other nations likewise believe Brussels' aim is to, quote, maintain a centralist superstate in which the member states increasingly lose their self-determination and are pushing for majority voting. So that gives you an idea of the nature of the European Union and the determination and the tactics that they have. Well, moving on to Europe's heritage and identity. Looking from both a political and a spiritual perspective, what is Europe? You know, Webster's Dictionary simply defines it as, quote, a continent between Asia and the Atlantic Ocean. What do the Europeans identify Europe with? Europa, a mythological Phoenician princess loved by Zeus, who, disguised as a white bull, some disguise, carried her off to Crete. It is this symbol of this goddess Europa riding a bull that Europe chose as their identification and their namesake, as reflected on some of their coins and postage stamps. And here we see Europa, a Phoenician princess from whom the name of the continent of Europe was taken. Brothers and sisters, this pagan symbology is consciously and deliberately used to represent Europe. This is what they want and determined to be associated with. Now in scripture, again, the woman sitting on the beast is identified as mystery battling the great. The whore, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, Revelation 17. Thus, she's identified with the Church of Rome. Keep in mind the relationship between the kings of the earth and the great whore. Not only are we told that they fornicate with her, but the inhabitants of the earth become drunk with the wine of her fornication. They have the states pretty much in their power. Notice, the papacy established its dominance by weaving together the temporal and the religious. The mother church extended her power and influence by usurping jurisdiction of civil governments. The blending of things civil and sacred was the papacy's method of operation, which made the papacy's will hard to resist. Now, this method of operation is still operative today. The whore system seeking to consolidate power within the European Union, a continuation of the church's medieval method of operation. Revelation 17. And there came one of the seven angels, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-covered beast full of the names of blasphemy. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Beginning in verse 15, within Revelation chapter 17, we find that the many waters that the woman sits upon are defined in verse 15 as peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. The scarlet-covered beast that the whore sits upon with seven heads and ten horns, in verse 3, represents the kingdoms of men. The seven heads are seven mountains indicating the seat of the woman, which in this case is Rome. The ten horns are ten kings, which receive power as kings for 1 hour, giving their power to the beast to make war with the Lamb, where, of course, they are overcome, verses 12 through 14. So here we are given to understand that the European nations, as representative of the Roman beast system, appear in their latter-day manifestation of the Great War period. Europe's heritage and identity is tied both to the Europa myth as well as to the Roman Church. Christianity has steadily declined in Europe. Today, Christians are a minority in many European countries. The use of a Christian identity contributes to the paradoxical secularization of Europe. European Christianity is more an identity than it is a practice religion. Europe may be a product of Christianity, but more precisely, a product of Latin Christianity, not the truth. The popes have traditionally supported Europe as well as actively reminded them of the Church's Christian values as a defining element of the European Union. At the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, 1957 through 2007, the Pope expressed a warning that Europeans were abandoning the faith and in danger of losing their identity. He urged, note this, a new political Christianity. A new political Christianity that would express value for, he said, the EU's Christian roots while strengthening their belonging to a common civilization. What might he have envisioned within a new political Christianity? What does Christianity have to do with politics? The papacy was redefining itself. And thus we might imagine that any success toward this goal would be political expediency and Christian in name only. Indeed, what does mankind's politics have to do with God or His will or His scriptures? Additionally, when the Pope told Europe that they were in danger of losing their identity, he was referencing not only the people's abandonment of Christianity, but also the growing presence and influence of Islam in Europe. That brings us to entering the screen, Eurabia. Eurabia. Over the past 30 years, the Muslim population in Europe expanded rapidly from a few hundred thousand to more than 20 million. It is beginning to dawn on Europeans that the combination of a shrinking ethnic European population and an expanding, culturally assertive Muslim population might lead to the fall of Western civilization in Europe within a century. This phenomenon called Eurabia is viewed with growing fatalism both in Europe and in America. Muslims are arguing among themselves over their role in Western societies. Should they integrate, seclude themselves, or convert the West to Islam? Many Muslims are content to be law-abiding, culturally integrated citizens, but an increasing number feel some degree of alienation, and many are beginning to believe that they have a religious duty not to integrate. Radical currents within Islam drive some Muslims to terrorism and push others at least to a more adversarial view of their relationship to their non-Muslim nations and cultures in which they live. Muslim sections of Paris, Rotterdam, and other European cities are already labeled no-go zones for ethnic Europeans, including armed policemen. Disconnected from their homelands, isolated from their non-Muslim neighbors and fellow workers, alienated from their elders, Europe's young Muslims find a weird, disembodied, radical Islam appealing. Complicating Europe's ability to counter such a growing force is the multiculturalism and political correctness advocated and institutionalized in national and European Union laws and regulations. Europe's effort at cultural tolerance since World War II slowly morphed into a surprisingly deep self-loathing of Western culture that denied the instinct for cultural and national self-defense. That's the Washington Times. That was back in 2005. Muslim assertiveness and violence is indeed an increasing problem for Europe, and particularly for France, with some French police officials calling Muslim uprisings an intifada. Note, France is home to one of Western Europe's largest Muslim population. Last I read, at 5.7 million Muslims. France's obsession with Islam is based on the concept that France is secular in nature. That's the French stand. We are a secular nation and are not Christian or Islamic. Yet every political statement or government policy that seeks to protect secularism and regulate Islam entangles state and religion ever closer. And that was a comment from Al Jazeera, October 27, 2022. Well, we have here a comment from the May 2006 Advocate. Church leadership support on behalf of liberal causes has unwittingly contributed to the de-Christianization of society, as reflected in court decisions banning prayer in schools, removal of nativity scenes from public squares, legalization of homosexual practice, gay marriage, etc., all of which contributes to society's abandonment of its religious and moral roots. Among the consequences of this trend is the plunge in birth rates within Western nations, with abortion, birth control, acceptance of casual sex and homosexuality driving it. Not a single Western European nation has a birth rate sufficient to replace the current population, which demographers say requires 2.1 children per family. Germany, Russia, Spain, Poland, and Italy all have rates of about 1.3, and I updated that to 1.3 up to 1.7 children. The U.S. rate remains stable at slightly more than 2. Well, now it's listed as 1.6. The European continent is becoming one vast leisure world, increasingly secular and pleasure-oriented, abandoning religion, growing older, shrinking and slowly killing itself. Facts not lost on Islamic extremists who define the Christian West as a dying force and pursue what they believe to be Islam's destiny as the rising global power. Well, there's one last European heritage element I want to review for our show. And it's another number of the European that the European architects chose to associate and to identify themselves with. And that is the EU's Parliament building in Strasbourg, France. Most of you are probably familiar with it. The EU has chosen the symbol of the Tower of Babel to represent their vision of many tongues, all with one voice. So we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. The images pretty much speak for themselves. And the first one is a painting by Peter Bruegel the Elder, painted in 1563. You're probably all familiar with that or have seen that. That's followed here by Strasbourg's Parliament Building in France. And you'll be able to see what the architects of the Parliament Building were attempting to identify with. And we're going to put these two side by side so you can get a better idea of what that part of the building was attempting to mimic. So then you can see them overlaid. And here you can see what they attempt to identify with. Europe's Tower of Babel, many tongues, one voice, actually refers back to Genesis 11, 1 through 9, is of great significance to the values of the Europeans. A Strasbourg-born journalist was asked if she understood the meaning of Europe's identification with the tower. She said she did, but she also confirmed that the members of the European Parliament also understood that it represented Babel from the Bible, and that the purpose of the European Union was to, quote, finish what Nimrod and the people together had failed to do some 3,500 years ago. How arrogant. The purpose of the European Union was to finish what Nimrod and the people together had failed to do some 3,500 years ago. Now one might ask, if the EU meant to have a secular state, or be in a secular state, why would it openly use symbols based on ancient biblical stories? Not stories, but biblical truths. Which according to the scriptural text, did not turn out good and ended up being destroyed. Brothers and sisters, the so-styled Christianity in Europe and in Rome is nothing short of blasphemy. Not only do they have no understanding of Yahweh, His Word, His works, His plan, His purpose, they are openly antagonistic to His will. Through their adoption of the Tower of Babel, the European Union promotes a defiant reversal of an act of God. They're going to correct it. And now I want to talk a little bit about Israel's values and attitudes and goals. What are Europe's values? We view Europe as a technically a post-Christian country at this point. One vast leisure world, increasingly secular and pleasure-oriented, abandoning Christianity, growing older, slowly shrinking. Well, so what do Europeans care about and are tolerating? Well, I have some examples, and I wasn't even going to put this in because it's just so outrageous. But it gives you an idea of what Europeans and European officials believe in or promote. Has Europe gone crazy? As the cultural war in North America grows ever more intense, it might give pause to know what sort of insanities are occurring in Europe, where secularists have already won. In the Netherlands, pedophiles are in the process of registering their own political party in order to more effectively push their agenda, including legalization of child pornography, bestiality, and lowering the legal age of consent from 16 to 12, with the goal of removing age of consent laws altogether. In Spain, the ruling socialist faction has proposed a law that would give fundamental legal rights to great apes. The idea arose from the Great Ape Project, which demands the extension of the community of equals to include all great apes, human beings, chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans. All such could not be imprisoned if they had not been convicted of a crime, and would have the right of appeal through a human legal advocate. In Germany, Women who are unemployed must be willing to work as prostitutes or risk losing unemployment benefits. Prostitution is legal in Germany, and Germany's welfare laws oblige women under 55 who have been out of work for more than a year to take an available job, including the sex industry, or lose their benefits. The government had considered making brothels an exception, but eventually ruled this out. I'll say. Though perhaps the Netherlands and Germany's insanity, may not reflect the same rate of foolishness in all the other 25 countries in this report from the Agape Press. For over the past 17 years, one might wonder what other laws and practices may have arisen within these godless secular nations. Where is their head? In a society where there is no right or wrong, where all things are possible, as we today observe, especially in both the U.S. and Canada, regarding the right and wrong sexual choice, LBG rights and prominence, pronouns, etc., history teaches us that where there is a void in purpose or in vision, as does the scripture, it will be filled. As in Europe, even in the U.S., nationalism, individual choice, and even our words are increasingly being restricted and outlawed. The EU has instituted lessons for secondary students to be taught throughout the 27 EU countries. Now, this is important because they want to get to all of those secondary students in all 27 of those countries. And it covers what they call EU values and history. It's proposed as an apprenticeship for EU students. In other words, you better learn this. And they must master 8 key competencies drawn up by the European Commission. Well, I'm going to have to admit, even North American education is fast heading in a similar direction. The goal with the EU is absolute conformity and control. The one voice to be observed is that of the elite leadership. The EU's global interests are to be primary and unopposed. This is from them. The Pope's new political Christianity is to again establish the primacy of the Church in its modern form. Now, this is by weaving together and blurring distinctions between the temporal and the religious. Well, moving on, the European Union on the world stage. What is this then? Well, let's look at the European Army. The EU Army are terms for a hypothetical army of the European Union, which could supersede the common security and defense policy and would go beyond the proposed European Defense Union. Currently, there is no such army, and defense is a matter for the member states. Is the European army in the making? Russia's war in Ukraine may be turning the European Union into a serious military player. The war in Ukraine, politicians and pundits agree, is the European Union's sudden birth as a serious military player. Germany has announced that it will dramatically increase its defense spending and is sending weapons to Ukraine, a previously unthinkable development. The European Union, heretofore mostly known as an outlet for voices against military aggression but does nothing, has already sent Ukraine military aid worth more than $500 million. But what exactly the EU's military role should be remains painfully unclear. Member states have widely different opinions on the matter, and European security is, of course, already being looked after by NATO. What exactly can the EU do to grow its military muscle without causing an affront to its Brussels neighbor? Severe crisis below NATO's Article 5 threshold, in a way, pose an opportunity for the EU to make a real military contribution. Its military committee, composed of member states' defense chiefs, has the daunting task of mapping a course. So it remains to be seen, you know, exactly what they will be doing or coming up with. You know, this is from foreignpolicy.com. Foreignpolicy.com is an American news publication focused on global affairs. Now, regarding the European Union and Israel, I couldn't find a whole lot on it, but the European Union and Israel, they do share a long history marked by growing independence and cooperation. The EU says, this is the EU, that they both share the same values of democracy, respect for freedom and the rule of law, and are committed to an open international economic system based on market principles. Over five decades of trade, cultural exchanges, political cooperation, and a developed system of agreements, they have cemented these relations. This is from a European website. For me, it reads somewhat suspiciously positive. I don't know whether Israel would want to make some changes or not. But perhaps in that the EU is Israel's biggest trading partner, accounting for 29.3% of its trade in goods in 2020. 34.4% of Israel's imports came from the EU, and 22% of the country's exports went to the EU. Total trade in goods between the EU and Israel in the year 2020 amounted to 31 billion euros. All of the official language and cooperation above is positive, but we know there's a negative side to the secular nature of the EU that condemns and considers Israel a pariah, if not a danger to the earth. What is it about the EU that will cause it to declare Israel an enemy of the world, as well as to make war with the Lamb? Well, you know, can't really put my finger on anything specific now, but essentially everything the EU is and stands for. Keep in mind, the EU is an economic union dependent on Middle East and Russian oil. The EU has a large Muslim population in their 27 countries. They also have a long, long history of anti-Semitism, which has been growing in recent years, notably, we see that in France. Truly, Israel is a stumbling stone for all the world, and we know that. The fact that Israel is so prosperous and strong in the midst of their eternal enemies is a Nakba catastrophe, as it is termed by the Palestinians, as well as by most of the nations, as we observed within the United Nations books. The EU position is for Israel, of course, to share the land and institute the two-state solution. And brothers and sisters, I don't think that will ever happen as long as Israel exists. That's their ancestral homeland. Psalms 83 declares the removal of the surrounding enemy nations round about, rather than the removal of Israel. The European Union is no exception to promoting the two-state solution. This is never going to happen as long as Israel exists. The European Union is no exception to promoting the two-state solution and typically backs the Palestinians as the victims of Israeli aggression, complaining even about Jewish reprisals against Palestinian rockets and Palestinian violence. Yet, in a major policy reversal by Western members of the United Nations Human Rights Council, note this, all of its European Union member states voted against a permanent item singling out Israel. All 27 states voted against a permanent singling out of Israel. That was May 13, 2023, by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. That's really interesting. Now, thought that came to me was, might that be a concession to keep good trade relations? I don't know. It's interesting, you know, when you look back that God used gas and oil to enrich and embolden both the Arabs and Russia in these latter days. God gave that. He had a purpose in doing so. In the confederacy of the soon-developing Gogian host allied with Russia, do we not see the beast, the European Union, the dragon, the eastern pagan powers, which Allah just assigned to Russia, and the false prophet, Rome? In this we see the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet together making war with Israel, with Christ, and the saints. So moving on to Revelation. Revelation 16. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to battle, to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. In Revelation 17, I was shown to thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. And I saw a woman sit on a scarlet covered beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So we recognize Europe through its scriptural references, through these scriptural references. Likewise, we recognize Europe to encompass much of the home territory of the past Roman Empire, through which Europe developed into a Western ecclesiastical laying of the image of the kingdoms of men. Christadelphians have long looked to Europe as a manifestation of the ten-toed nations, the feet and toes, part of iron, and part of potter's clay, which certainly describes the European Union, some strong nations, some weak. Going to Daniel, and whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And thus we see evidence of that in the resistance still going on within the European Union. Now, last but not least, by any means, is the subject of the Ten Kings, which is a tough, maybe a controversial subject in terms of interpretations. But we'll just briefly review it. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Now, this verse on the screen clearly addresses an end-time prophetic fulfillment. Notice that last phrase in verse 14. They that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Clearly a reference to the immortalized saints with Christ. Also significant is the term the 1 hour in verse 12 and the one mind in verse 13. That the kings all, that these kings share, the term kings. And thus we might conclude that one mind kings quite possibly are now in the process of being ready to give their power and their authority to the beast. Having maybe been preparing throughout, preparing throughout their 1 hour role, although it's unclear just exactly what duration one prophetic hour really is. And so I don't want to go into that, but you know, is it 30 days? Is it a month? Is it 30 months? Some even have speculated 30 years. You know, so although we cannot rule out maybe any of these possibilities, you know, when the kings are actually going to give their power to the beast. And we really can't be confident as to the nature and strength of the power referenced within this prophetic time period. Is it those two nations that have weapons and maybe nuclear weapons? I don't know. This is a question which might be fully understood only after the prophecy is fulfilled. Likewise, the title of kings, I think Dr. Thomas said, you know, kings may be interpreted as something else. They represent nations or powers or authorities, in other words, in that the beast, the seven heads, the ten horns, all of these things are signified, as we read in Revelation 1:1, that his message was a revelation was signified. And though may we well expect the ten kings to come out of the European Union as those toe nations which reflected the strength of iron, the word kings may likewise refer to other entities. Also, they're going to be, whatever it is, it's going to be motivated by the Roman Church. And just as the Europe occupies the Roman domain, reflecting its location and its character. Well, that probably wasn't too helpful there, but brother, in conclusion, when we examine Europe's attachment to their past, their secular nature, their godless character, their prosperity, and their control and rule over the majority of the European continent, not to leave out their close relationship with Papal Rome, one can see that when Christ comes, they will be motivated to make war with the Lamb. Papal Rome telling them that it's the Antichrist and they must face him and overcome him. God's word will not, you know, because you know, the Pope isn't going to say, yeah, that's Christ. He's not going to say that. That's got to be the Antichrist for the Latin world. We know God's word will not return unto him void. How blessed we are to have been given instruction on what is to occur in the near future, that we might have confidence and not be ashamed before him at his coming. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brother Jim.